So KITS is a survey that we're going to start next year. It's a very large molecular imaging survey. And so I gave a talking about this at UCLA last week to a much more general audience for this, and I basically took the relevant design to come up here, so I'll try to keep this reasonably short. So what I'll try to do is go very quickly through the weak lensing introduction, since most of you should have seen some of this stuff before. And I made most of what I'm going to describe is the survey itself, and then the plans we have with it for the lensing aspects, the galaxy gap lensing, and cosmic shapes. And in the end of this time, I'll go in some detail into some of the new methods we're developing to make some of this stuff more accurate.
Can you see the pointer?
Yeah.
To make this, to try to get high precision measurements with those systems. So, this is weak lensing without formulae. This is if we're looking at a distant source and there's a massive object somewhere along the line of sight. The massive object is somewhere along the line of sight, and the light rays that we're supposed to see, in fact, don't make it to us, but they get deflected. And so instead, what we see as poor observers is we see the light rays coming from the wrong direction, and so the source actually appears further from the lens than it was supposed to. So because we're tracing light rays backwards, it's actually counterintuitive that it's as if a massive object pushes the sky around it away, and along with that push, you get a squeezing because you're distorting the sky. And so this is the pattern that you look for around any massive object in the sky. There's a preferential, very subtle, but preferential bending of alignment of the background sources. And if the source is no longer round, then it's flatter, and then you get a characteristic n equals 2 modulation of the background. So that's each year in pictures. And what we're going to do with KITS is to try to find this very subtle effect. You cannot see this on a visual basis, you really have to look for this statistically, using a huge sample of some 80 million background galaxies from a large white validity survey, targeting an area of the sky where there's redshifts for about 200,000 So we really will be able to look for this preferential alignment, tangential alignment, with very high signal to noise, by the power of the thing. That's the main idea of them. So this is what people haven't seen. Actually, the reason I put this left this in the talk is that I don't know who made this movie. Do you know where this came from? I found this on the web, but it's never been attributed. It should move. So this is a background screen being moved in front of a foreground model cluster. And it's a very nice illustration of this effect that you're actually pushing the background sources away from the lens as you're tracking this. Okay. I'm not telling you anything about that. This is the mass. You've all seen this before. The only important thing is that the lensing potential is the only thing that matters that describes the lens, the projection of the 3D potential of the lenses. And that tells you the deflection, it tells you the distortion, and in the end what we can measure is a combination of the magnification of the convergence and the shear called G, the distortion. The shear divided by 1.
Sorry, I just need to actually
the robot.
This is my chance to say things which do not get recorded. Right, and so this is how you get from the lens to the deflection angle. And so all we can measure in weak lensing is this quantity G, which is basically the tendency for round sources to become elliptical. And weak lensing, by definition, these numbers here are very, very weak. We're looking for very, very subtle distortions, things that you certainly cannot detect when you look at an individual source. You have to look for statistically. Okay, so the propaganda. Is it working now? So the propaganda is that the big advantage of these weak lensing, or in fact any lensing survey, is that you're really looking at the total mass distribution
directly. All the gravitational field is helping to cause the lensing, so you're studying the gravity directly, independent of whether there's dark or light sources of the gravity. But in practice, this is difficult to make, to really realize to the full. You're projecting stuff along a very, very long sight line that you have to understand quite well. It's also extremely noisy in the weak lensing regime because each background galaxy has, of course, a large intrinsic projected ellipticity that we're just perturbing very slightly with lensing. And very accurate shape measurements require very good control of the systematics. It sounds simple, measure an ellipticity of an object, but it's actually very, very difficult to do this accurately. And this has really kept a lot of people very busy, and we're still not there. And finally, if you want to actually interpret the measurement shear that you measured distortion that you get on the sky, you need to know the distances to derive this critical surface density, which scales into everything if you want to make everything dimensional. So there's a lot of issues to turn a measurement, or to turn an image into a measurement, and to turn a measurement into physics. Okay, so let me tell you about the survey. It's actually two projects that were submitted to ESO. One is called KIDS, which is the optical part, and then after that came Viking, which is the infrared part. In total, they will cover from U-band to K-band an area of 1,500 square degrees on the sky. And there's a large number of people in here, as you have to for such a big project. So here's Paranal, seen from the air last year sometime. And you see that there's the four VLTs, of course. The swimming pool is somewhere over here. But the two things that are important for this project is Vista, which is on the peak next to Paranal, on a peak called the Vista Peak. Now, it used to be called the NTT Peak. It's a 4-meter telescope that's specifically dedicated to wide field imaging in the near infrared. It's got a monster of a detector system, 0.6 square degrees instantaneous field of view, 16 2K by 2K detectors. And it's being built right now. If you look in this dome now, there's at least half a telescope there. And then this other dome here, this little one peeping out behind the third of the VLTs, is the dome for the VST, the VLT Survey Telescope, which is an optical 2.6 meter telescope, again, purely dedicated to wide field imaging, and its focal plane has a square degree optical camera called OmegaCam, which we were responsible for building. And so ESO has big plans for these telescopes. They want to use them for large surveys, so they had a procedure to try to establish which surveys it was going to be. And we did very well in that procedure, and we ended up walking away with 440 nights in the optical and 250 nights in the infrared. So we're going to be busy. So this is the VST. It's, as I said, specifically designed for this wide field imaging. So it's not a pre-existing telescope that you then try to retrofit a camera on to get a nice big field of view. It's really all the optical parameters were optimized together to make this beautiful flat field of view. And so we have very little distortion, very good PSF over the full square degree field of view all the way into the corners. Everything is active. The secondary can be moved. The primary can be bent in many modes, again, to ensure that you get a very good image quality at all times. And it'll just have this one instrument, so it'll be very stable. No instrument changes, no people messing around. And so this machine will be able to get something like 10 terabytes of pixel data per year. Basically, if you turn it on and you use it, that's what you're going to get, whether you like it or not. So you have to be prepared to swallow this amount of data, which again is not trivial, but not impossible. So here's the dome a few years ago. This is the inside of the dome a few years ago, and still today, unfortunately. Big hole where the telescope is going to go. This is the primary mirror when it arrived on Paranal a few years ago. See, there was a slight bump in the road, as they say. A new one is being ordered now, so this was a very tragic story, actually, this mirror. And of course, now about the dead, you say nothing but good things, and so everybody now agrees this was an absolutely fabulous mirror that would have made a great instrument. But anyway, the new one is coming. Insurance rates for transporting telescope mirrors have gone up, unfortunately, since this accident. And this is the telescope as it is now in Naples in the factory where it's now undergoing final testing before being shipped to Paranal. I can't give you an exact number for that. What I'm told is that scientific operations before the end of next year, but not much before the end of next year. The mirror is also on its way. It's in the same factory as the Vista mirror, which is a bit delayed. So there's all these various strands that come together, but 2007 is when it's all going to happen, is the claim. Okay, and so in the focal plane we have OmegaCam, the camera that we built. This is the detector mosaic. It's similar in concept to MegaCam on CFHT, 32 detectors. And if you think about it for a second, you can see that these are not the real detectors, because they're far too shiny. They're throwing all the photons back instead of keeping them. So these are technical ones that are designed to just see if the, if all the holes were in the right place. You're very good. I'm impressed. Usually I just get dumbfounded silence in that question. This is what the camera really looks like. This is the real detectors in the detector system. And the detector system was basically closed last week, and it's just waiting to be shipped to the telescope. Each of these detectors is 2,000 by 4,000 pixels. I'll come to those in a second. Those are for guiding and for focusing.
What's the physical scale? Is it what the detector
is? Square, yeah. It's 15 micron times 16,000 pixels.
Are the gaps there on
purpose? You can't avoid them because these are the readout registers for the. They're on the side. So, in fact, these are really gold bonded wires, so they're very reflective. So, we have to baffle them to make sure you don't get disgusting ghosts in the image. But this is as close. This is actually, the packages are basically within a tenth of a millimeter of each other, the whole devices. It's just as close as you can get the pixels. So those detectors on the side are there for keeping the image quality good. So two of them are for guiding not only just the position on the sky, but also the rotation, because this is such a large field that you have to keep track of rotation. So we'll use two guide stars. And then the other two CCDs are actually mounted out of focus. One is in front of the focus, one is behind the focus. And that allows you to keep the focus of the telescope even during the observations in principle. So the principle is very simple. It's a Rodier-type system that if you have a perfect focus, this is the focal plane, then of course all the light rays meet in the focal plane, and if you were to cut the focal plane or the beam in front and behind, you would see that at equal distances the beam is the same size, because it's a nice cone. If you're out of focus on the one side, you'll get a bigger defocused image than on the other. Right? And so this actually tells you which way you have to focus and by how much. So by measuring defocused images simultaneously, you can tell the telescope how to correct for defocus. That's the idea. Yeah. This hasn't been done before in this system on any telescope, so we'll implement this in stages, but the capability is there. And so this is, of course, just a one-dimensional cut, but in fact you have to think of this as a cone, and so you can see astigmatism if the focus is different in one direction and the other, and all these things can be corrected. And so that's what these are two CCDs here are for, that are one in front and one in behind the focal plane.
Does MegaCom have a similar system?
No. I don't think so. There's another MegaCam on the MMT, which does have a similar system, except they implement this focus change by putting pieces of different thickness glass in front of the CCDs instead of by physically mounting them differently. And so these things will be continuously monitoring bright stars in this part and this part of the field, and those two things tell you all about the high-order aberration. So this is what those two stars will look like. If everything is focused, they should look similar. If there's some coma, then you'll see that the images shift to one side. If there's astigmatism, you get this. Each of them will be elliptical in a particular way, and these are higher order distortions. And so you can simultaneously fit for all of these and simply tell the telescope how to shape its mirror.
Which was the secondary?
And the primary. So the coma you do with the secondary, and this you do with the primary. The question is how often you have to do the primary, but in principle you can do this, either during or between exposure. Once the telescope is working, I can answer that question. But the idea is you can do this in between all exposures or even during exposures, if the exposures are low. Well, much of this you can do through lookup tables, of course, too. So you can do this actively or passively. Or so you can also use it just to monitor what the telescope is doing and then encode that in tables and predict it. Anyway, this is a separate story. And so this is how the system works. And then I will shut up about this. I was involved in designing this, so I'm quite thinking about it. So this is very fast moving. In real time, it won't go quite so fast. This is the 2D focused images. This is on axis, and you see that if you have a... this is all kinds of modes up there. There's 4 implemented in very high amplitude, so this is a very defocused image and very bad structure. And you can see this is a simulation where you simply use the information in the defocused images and the ray tracing, tell it to reconfigure the telescope, and in a few iterations, it gets back to where it's supposed to go. This was supposed to loop, but as I say, my computer isn't very happy today, so I can show you the loop later. Anyway, it works. This is what the talk is about. This is the survey. 2 patches, the northern galactic cap and the south galactic cap. The telescope is on Parnell, so we can't go very far north. So the north galactic cap is on the equator, covering basically the southern edge of the Sloan Strip. So this red area is the Sloan DR3, and there's more up here. The red area we will only cover in I to complement the UKIDS, which is an infrared survey being done from UKIRT in Hawaii. With short exposures, we will complement that with I because it helps tremendously with finding high redshift quasars and brown dwarfs and things. The main survey for the lensing is these blue areas, both on the equator here and around the South Galactic Pole here. Each patch is about 750 square degrees. And these solid dots are our random subset of the 2DF galaxy redshift survey. So we're basically targeting the 2DF area on the sky, 200,000 redshifts in this area, which in the north is also the southern edge of Sloan. We're overlapping a little bit with the CFHT survey to be able to cross-check our lensing results. And then out here we have the UKIDS infrared and the Sloan imaging, which will complement with deeper eye than what SDSS can provide. Okay, so that's what's going to keep us busy. And we'll overlap with COSMOS also for obvious reasons. Can't have a survey that doesn't look at the COSMOS field. Right. And the whole area covers something like nearly 4% of the surface of the sky, which on Earth would correspond to the whole continent of South America, for what it's worth. Just sounds good. In fact, if you project the Earth in a good way in Google Earth, it actually looks much bigger than it really is. So the equivalent is, if you look at the pixel size, it would be all of South America at 6-meter pixels. Right? So it's really comparable to Google Earth, but then on the sky. And it would be quite fun to put surveys like this in the same sort of interface. Okay.
Work on that? Do you work on that?
I don't. There is a guy. It's being done. This.
Ryan Smith is doing this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Only the beta version.
Right.
That should be quite fun.
I know that'd be a poop. It's quite interesting.
So these are the limiting magnitudes. On the right here, this is the optical part and the infrared part. For a while, we thought we would do Z using the VST CCDs, but they're kind of thin and giving a lot of fringing. And since Vista now has a Z filter, we'll use Vista, which will be much more efficient. So limiting magnitudes are here in this column. One. So this is how much the signal to not. This is the brightness of a source which, within a 2 arc second radius, gives you a 5 sigma detection. It's a sort of standard. Good question. Diameter, I think. For the lensing, it's important that we control the seeing, that we at least have one good seeing image in all bands. And so what we've done is we've divided the conditions into moon phase and seeing, and we know the statistics on Parnell very well. And so whenever it's dark and the seeing is in the best 40 percentile, the best 40% of the distribution, we will go for R band observations. So those are our deeper observations, 1800 seconds, half an hour integration. And so that means we should end up with a median seeing of about 0.6, which the camera may degrade a little bit to 0.7. But anyway, it should be superb image quality in at least one band over the full 1500 square degrees. And then depending on the seeing, we will choose different bands. So this is all Q mode observing, where you can respond quickly to differing conditions. It's not only ours. There's other people that want to use the telescope. So probably what will happen is that the eye, much of that will be done in bright time with longer integrations, and much of the gray time will go to a galactic plane survey. Also, you'll notice that the worst 20% of seeing isn't being used in this. There's a different project called ATLAS that Tom Shanks is leading, and they will basically do an SDSS depth survey in poor seeing to really match SDSS in detail. Right, poor seeing means worse than 1.1 arc seconds. And they will just cover a large area of the southern sky in the Sloan bands. Our filters are very similar to the Sloan filters, in fact. Okay, I think I've told you everything about that. And so the infrared part, this is what we'll do with Vista. UKIDS has already started and is providing this, and so we'll go about 1.5 magnitudes deeper than Vista in these bands. So it's really worth going over these patches again to get deeper infrared data. Okay, so this is an idea of what image quality you would get. This is a simulation where we've taken a deep force image and degraded it to what we expect KIDS will provide in terms of seeing and depth and pixel scale, and the same for SDSS. And so you see that compared to SDSS, indeed, you'll see many more sources and you'll be able to tell much more about them morphologically. So we really sit in between Sloan and CFHTLS in terms of area, in terms of depth, and in terms of image quality. So that's a nice piece of face space for a big survey. It's worth putting all this effort into it. Okay. So the only way you get huge amounts of time like that at ESO is to try to be all things to all people. So this is a large public survey, which was a very broad science case that's designed to satisfy a large community, which is good. It also means we're committed to providing images to the community in a reasonable time scale. And so the science case, the reason why we got into this in the first place is, of course, the lensing aspects, both the dark matter and the dark energy issues, which I'll talk about next. But there's also many things you can do in terms of studying galaxy evolution versus environment, in terms of looking for clusters, high redshift quasars, white dwarf searches, etc. You've seen how broad a science case Sloan has, or how broad an impact Sloan has had, and there's no reason why this shouldn't be any different. So, for example, looking for high redshift quasars by combining the infrared, you basically look for things that you don't see at all in the optical, but that you do see in the infrared. And by combining with UKIDS and later with VISTA, you can track the brown dwarf sequence. And by having this Y filter, which sits in between Z and J, you can distinguish very nicely a Lyman alpha line tracking through this filter from the photosphere of a brown dwarf. So this is should be a very powerful way of finding quasars further than Z is 6.5 or so. And expectations, of course, are there to be proven or disproven, but we reckon there should be about 7 in the survey area, if only we can find them. Okay. So the median redshift of galaxies that we detect in the survey at 10 sigma, it will be something like 0.7. And so these are typical SEDs for galaxies at redshift 1, which is what we've been using to check our photometric redshift accuracy. And so early type, intermediate age, and very star-forming galaxies, you can very nicely define the SED with those 8 bands that we're going to be getting from the survey. 9 bands, sorry. Okay, and huge amount of data means that we will have a data flow problem, as it's called, or data flow issue. The way we've attacked this is we'll actually have 6 different data centers in Europe that will each be processing part of the data with overlaps to provide cross-checks, and then we'll have various internal deliveries before we finally release the data. And we've built a system called AstroWISE, which stands for Astronomical Wide Field Imaging System for Europe, with European money, which is a combination of a huge federated database that you can access from lots of different places and work in from different places and replicate in clever ways, plus pipeline processing that you drive through SQL and similar queries. So it means that effectively you have database-wide control of all the calibration and quality control that's being done all over the survey, which is really what we need to be able to efficiently work with these gigantic volumes of data. So in some ways, we're playing mini virtual observatory and mini grid, but we're doing it within our own confines, which means we don't have to talk too much to all the people that are setting standards. We can do our own thing and learn something useful, which hopefully then will be useful to other people as well. Okay. So that's it about the survey. Let's get to the science. So we've had this discussion the last few days. So I wrote this a couple of weeks ago, but I think it's the discussion yesterday pretty much went along the same lines, that if you want to study dark halos and see what the theories predict, there's very clear predictions on 100 kiloparsecs and up scales. At smaller scales, things get messy because of the baryons, but out there, the dark matter dominates the potential, the gravity dominates the physics, and the baryons don't do too much. And this is therefore a very interesting regime in principle, but in practice, it's very hard to test. Rotation curves, basically all the baryonic traces almost by definition are not out there, and so they're difficult to look at. There's some work with satellite galaxies that was discussed yesterday, but it's really quite poor and patchy, and you really want to do a much better job. And then the large-scale structure, which of course motivated all the CDM in the first place, starts at much, much larger radii. So this is the nice range to try to attack. So what can you do there? Well, you can, of course, check whether you have the right size halos around the galaxies that you see. You can try to measure the radial profile, as we've been discussing at length. And I think what's very important is you can measure the shapes of dark halos around various kinds of galaxies, around edge-on disks, around round ellipticals, etc. And this, I think, is really a very fundamental way of trying to put very simple physics constraints on the kind of gravity law that we have in this universe. And you may think that's a worthwhile thing to do or not, but I think this is simply a measurement that can have significant impact there. And the best place to do all this is at these large radii where you think you know that it's just the gravity and the dark matter that are dominating your signal.
Excuse me, how do you do the shape of dark matter halos?
So we know from CDM simulations that they... You mean how do you measure it, or how do you...
Yeah, how you measure it. Because if you don't have just a reference frame, you use the galaxies as reference.
You use the major axis of the galaxy as your...
Okay, so you have to do that, right?
Yeah.
You cannot really just measure this directed from Nancy itself, because...
No, if galaxies are sitting completely randomly in very elongated halos, you would never tell. You would just smear out over all that.
So average over...
So in fact, what you're measuring is an alignment between...
Yeah, okay, then I...
And I think it's reasonable... Pardon? You would see that. You would see that the shear profile... Yes, it is modulated at the... So basically, you look for an M equals 2 modulation in the tangential shear around the galaxy, and you see how that's aligned with the major axis. And depending on the sign of it, it's either co-aligned or counter-aligned. But if they're at 45 degrees, then you will never see it because you will... 90, plus and minus 90 you can do. And I think that's good enough for many of these questions.
So the Yahtzee shear three-point function should also probe the shapes independently of the alignment of the Yahtzee. It should independent, I think, of the alignment of the Yahtzee with respect to the... I mean, I think you can separate out the alignment of the...
We should talk about it, okay.
If the halo is twisted, you would get a problem.
Yes. You would dilute the signal.
Yeah.
I think there would still be some tendency for alignment. And so what you can't tell is how flattened the halos are versus how aligned they are. You measure a combination of those two things.
So when we look into that, from simulation, we haven't met an idea of how strong that signal
is. I don't think it's been looked at in detail, but it would be good to do. So, because I don't have real data yet, this is... What I can do is I can make theoretical plots. So let's assume that we take 10,000 big galaxies in the survey, 10,000 foreground galaxies that we plonk out of Sloan or SDSS with good redshifts, which would be something like a 20th of the foreground galaxies that we have. And let's see if we can measure the truncation radius of the potential. So let's try various models. This is the shear profile as a function of projected radius on the sky. I'm taking the source to be at 0.1. You can scale things to lie them on top of each other properly. And this is the model here for a singular isothermal sphere with a dispersion of 200 kilometers a second. So it's a hefty galaxy, without truncation, with some truncation, with more truncation. Right. Now, the kind of measurement that we'll be able to make is of this accuracy. These are all independent bins. So this is how well we can measure the shear around such galaxies. Right. The error bar, I've taken the size of the bin so that the error bars are the same in every bin. So this is how much information you get out to 10.
So these 10,000 foreground galaxies, what kind of redshift are we talking about?
I'm assuming they're 0.1.
It's a 0.1.
Assuming 0.1. And I've taken that we'll have 20 galaxies per square arc minute in the background that are useful for shape measurements, which is a reasonable number, I think.
And how would you distribute the damage
ratio? I've assumed some effective beta over half, so... I think it's a reasonable assumption.
I forget what angular scale is the rest of the classical structure here.
Well, this is a megaparsec, so out here they already you have to worry about it. So in fact, what you would really do is as we discussed yesterday, is model every halo as a certain truncated thing, and then see how the clustering raises the tails of the mass function.
So this picture is from an isolated galaxy.
This is for an isolated galaxy. So this is purely, So it's a best case. In practice, you will end up with more signal here from surroundings, which you have to work hard to subtract properly.
So if you have the signal, you can go after the buffer.
Maybe you would make something that looks a little bit like the top curve. I'm not sure whether you would already hear.
And you'll get the perfect isothermal profile that goes away.
Yes, everything is perfectly isothermal.
No.
So
what are you doing here?
Excuse me. Why can't you go to even smaller
scales? Let's see, but then you.
Well, but the error bar is still quite small, right?
Yeah.
sorry, why can't you go to even smaller scale, say 20 kiloparsec?
You could do, but
what?
You could.
Yeah, because your error bar there does not blow up, and you can.
No. I mean, it's basically, so to get the same size and area, you just need the same area of sky.
Uh-huh.
Right? And so as you make your annuli smaller, you can either make the annuli smaller and the noise higher, or you can make the annuli fatter. So this is just the way, it's an artifact of the bidding in a sense. Now, of course, when you measure something like this, supposing we measure the middle curve, then you wouldn't actually know how to normalize it vertically, but still you can see that the shapes of the curves are significantly different, that you could modulo this business of mass at large radii. You could you could really distinguish these various truncation radii just from the shape of the curve. Right? Not in detail, but it should be the same rate as everybody else, right?
Well, it depends. So it's very sensitive on the C, right? So you have a very good thing. So you should probably be able to scale up the fraction of the C if it's people to find you. And you may find a sizable number.
Maybe this is. I mean, we're still at less than a percent out here. So.
Okay.
So no more than 10 is the correct thing. But we're not as deep as... That's in the deep part of CFHT, which is much deeper than what... Well, that would be 1,500. So
yeah.
I don't think we'll get that many. So this is more or less the state of the art of galaxy-galaxy lensing at the moment. This is the Hoekstra et al. Result from the RCS survey. You have a beautiful shear profile over several decades in radius. This is a log scale. This is 10 to the minus 1, 2, 3, 4. So they really have a very exquisite accuracy measurement. The cross term that's supposed to be zero if it's a lensing signal is indeed zero, so that's also very nice. And they were able to model this by putting a halo around every galaxy and seeing what truncation radius and sigma star you would get if you scale things properly. And so they were, again, we discussed this yesterday, they would find they actually find a detection for a turnover in the shear profile of an individual halo. They find a detection of a truncation radius. And this is something we could do much better. So they assume, this is the Rickson-Schneider type model, so it's a single isothermal that turns over in 2 and 1 over r to the 4th, I think. And then you assume that it scales with luminosity in a certain way to stack all the galaxies properly. And if you made a different assumption, you'd get a very different result, I'm sure. And the other thing is that they had a tentative detection at the few sigma level, this is delta chi-squared of 1 and delta chi-squared of 4, of a tendency for the halos, the projected mass distributions, to be flatter than the light. Or to be aligned and to be flatter by a factor of 0.8 or so. So they can rule out formally, i.e. they can't rule out an F is 1, which means the same shape at the 2 sigma level. You can't rule it out, but interesting. It's interesting, you can scale off this to see how well a bigger survey would do. So with kids, we'll get errors that are about 6 times smaller just from the number of foreground-background pairs that we will have in the survey. Plus, we'll be able to do a much better job at rejecting pairs which are the wrong way around, where the foreground galaxy is actually in front of the lens, because we'll have very good photometric redshifts and spectroscopic redshifts for the lenses. And we'll have many more colors, so you can subdivide the sample into different galaxy types and check the scaling relations and maybe even measure them to some extent. Right.
The number of lenses you had on the previous slide, are they all spectroscopic?
There's 200,000. It's the SDSS survey. Of course, many of those are redshift 0.0 few, which won't lens very strongly. But about half of them are redshift 0.1 or higher, and that's certainly enough. Okay, so the other thing we can do, this is how I'm dressed when I'm in Leiden in the cold, by the way. So this is how you can use foreground lenses just as a cosmological probe. Forget about the fact that they tell you something about galaxies, just use the fact that there's a lens there. Then if you have the source at a different distance, the lens is always the same in each of the frames of this little movie that bends the light by the same amount, but you see that the deflection angle, the difference between where the source would have been without the lens and where you see the image, increases as you push the lens to larger distance. Right? So that's the distance effect of lensing. which means that if you understand a lens well enough and you have various sources behind it, as you can do behind this ensemble of foreground lenses that we'd get from the weak lensing, you can try to map this function of how the lensing strength increases with distance, and that tells you something about geometry. Because, of course, we're in an expanding universe, and that means there's some extra. It's a bit difficult to draw this really, but this is kind of schematic. That the expansion of the universe also affects how the light rays propagate, and so that adds a little bit of extra to this bending angle here. Right. And this is what you can try to measure by seeing how the bending angle differs for sources at different redshifts. Right. And so that's your cosmological probe. It's a purely geometric way, and I think it would be beautiful if this could work, because it's independent of everything else. You don't need to know the lenses, you just need to know that they're the same lenses statistically for all the background galaxies. And it's a way of directly probing the expansion history via the angular diameter distance. And of course, this is how we can try to learn something about the evolution of dark energy, although the precision that you need is really phenomenal. Okay, then cosmic shear. Again, you all know this. If you have a mode on the sky in the mass distribution, it gives you a mode in the lensing potential and hence a mode in the ellipticities, which again is a direct measure of that mode of the power spectrum, modulo the odd Bessel function here and there. And so the evolution of the power spectrum amplitude can be traced directly, and again, that's a direct cosmological probe. Fundamental test of the gravitational instability picture, and the expansion history of the universe enters there also. And if you can measure the details, again, it tells you about the cosmological parameters like W and so on. So here is the maths, which I'll just skip. It's the expansion history and the growth history, plus nonlinear effects on small scales, which are important and difficult to predict with the sufficient accuracy to do this game at the moment, actually. But so here are the pictures. This is the angular diameter distance as a function of redshift. This is from the Dark Energy Task Force that looked into this in some detail. And this is a red and a green curve plotted on top of each other. One is for a pure lambda and one is for a W is minus 0.9 model. And so you see how difficult it is to distinguish these things from the angular diameter distance, which is basically lensing strength. And this is the ratio of those two curves, and you see it's at the percent and sub-percent level. This is the same for the growth rate. It's a little bit more significant. There's a bigger difference. And here you actually get 1% over a large range. So that's the kind of effect you're trying to measure if you want to use the variation of lensing strength with redshift as a probe, either in the cosmic power spectrum or in the galaxy-galaxy lensing strength as a cosmological probe to test the expansion history. And so depending on your personality, you think this is hopeless or this is very exciting. And I'm sitting on the fence, I must confess. I think it would be great if we could do this, but I wouldn't be surprised if we couldn't. The mic is on. That was a dangerous thing to say. Okay. The most accurate results from cosmic shear so far are from the CTIO survey and the CFHTLS survey, and they're basically at the level where they can measure sigma 8 now with a reasonable degree of accuracy. So let me show you those results very briefly. This is from Jarvis et al., the CTIO survey, where they take the lensing result, the CMB WMAP 1, I think this was, and the supernova results, and you see that in the omega matter sigma 8 plane, you get this beautiful convergence of the three models, which suggests that we're doing something right. And even on W, you can begin to put some constraints, and it's well below zero, and it's around minus 1. That's the sort of level where lensing is at the moment. Assuming the usual priors that things are flat and the W is constant. If you don't do that, then things very quickly fall apart. Okay, that's the CTIO survey. CFHTLS came out also this year. This is the Hoekstra-Dahl result from the wide survey, something like 20 square degrees. And this is from the deep survey, beautiful agreement in terms of the sigma 8 omega matter. So basically you measure the amount of clustered matter in the universe, so there's either not very much matter that's very clustered, or there's a lot of matter that's not very clustered. That's why you get this degeneracy. And again, if you compare this now with the WMAP 3 data, as Spergel et al. Did, then you get this mild inconsistency between the WMAP preferred bit of parameter space and the CFHTLS parameter space. And so you end up with this unhappy medium compromise value for sigma 8. Right? And so a little bit of a meal has been made of this. Now, PowerPoint may be horrible, but you can do one thing with it, which is quite nice, which is put figures on top of each other. And this is, underneath was the CFHTLS result as published by CFHTLS, and this is the CFHTLS result as quoted by the WMAP3 people. And for some reason, they are actually more discrepant than if you take the WMAP version of the WMAP result and the CFHTLS version of the CFHTLS result, in which case they actually overlap at the one sigma level. So I'm not quite sure what's going on here, but I think it may affect how exactly what you assume for the redshift distribution of the sources. But again, it illustrates that when people say that lensing gives a low sigma 8 and WMAP gives a high sigma 8, they're actually consistent, I would say. Yeah, so they mumble something about priors and redshift distributions. I'm not sure. I think what happened was that the WMAP team asked the CFHCLS team for their result in some form, and then they worked with it. And I don't know. I don't know what they did. And I'm not saying that what they did wasn't sensible, but that's why there is a difference. It's not a direct. It just illustrates how subtle interpreting these weak lensing measurements is, because of the non-lensing aspects like redshifts that you have to understand properly. And so even if there is a discrepancy, it maybe isn't very serious, because you're actually measuring quite different things. The sigma 8 that you get from the CMB actually sits out here at L of 2000, so it's an extrapolation of the model, whereas the sigma 8 that you measure from a weak lensing survey like CFHT is actually in the range that you're probing directly. And so it might point to a very slight tilt or some other change in the model. If you do believe that this is significant, then there's lots of let-out clauses in the lensing. You might have the wrong redshift distribution for the sources. You might have made some mistake in the calibration, which is not impossible. And you might have a mistake in the nonlinear evolution of the.
All right. To what scales could you? What would be the large scale you could do with the lensing?
Out here, 20. So this is almost a degree. This is more than half a degree. On which you're calculating the correlation function of the ellipticity.
Yeah, and let's say if you go to the degree scale, wouldn't you then be also in the range which is directly probed?
It's getting close.
I'm just wondering, instead of using some artificial sigma 8, should people just measure sigma 50? Yeah.
You just measure the power spectrum. Yeah. You measure the power spectrum now, and you measure the power spectrum then, and you
even for statistics, measure as a normalization, but on a scale that can be resolved by an ESA survey.
Yeah. If they are measuring different things, then what do you have to do? What change do you have to make to the model of structural measurement to make all measures?
So let me first of all say I don't think there is a significant discrepancy, so it's not worth investing a lot of time into it, I think. But if you tilted the power spectrum a little bit, for instance, that would do the trick, I think. Because then you would effectively extrapolate this differently to high L. Then. But I'm not an expert on this, but it's.
Yeah, but it means I'm just trying.
Yes, so the hidden parameter. Well, so I think the thing that makes this move is basically your assumption for what the median redshift is of the source galaxies. So that's in fact not a free parameter, that's something you just. There's only one correct number, and you should be able to measure it. But it's hard. So I think it's just a measurement
instead. Still, it's in the wrong direction. You need n to be.
I don't know. I'm thinking, as I say, I don't think this is very significant. So with kids, we'll be able to play this game too, and we'll get an independent result. So we've made sure we overlap with a significant chunk of the CFHT wide survey to be able to test the lensing systematics in excruciating detail. But we'll have a much larger area, so we'll be able to get better statistics and largely independent statistics also. And you can begin now to use cosmic shear also by tomography to comparing results from low and high redshifts from the wide and the deep survey. You can begin to say something about the equation of state, but it's very. Yeah.
How much the upper tip depends on how far down you go on the lower curve?
So there's a prior in here, they marginalize over sigma 8. They say sigma 8 is probably between 0.7 and 1. And I think that's why you get these square contours, because they've chopped off bits of parameter space. Oh, at the bottom here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I never understand what's the sensible thing to do. Because whatever you do, you get a different answer.
At the bottom, I don't think it's constrained at the bottom.
Numerical
it's a total error. You're saying, like, you know, that error that could in principle go down to infinity, and then like that artificially.
You mean if you want to know? You mean if you want to know what the omega matter is, what prior you put on W? Is that the?
Well, the limit you put on W.
So all people are quoting as an upper limit on W.
Does everybody agree with the prior that W naught should be larger than
2? No idea. I think if you have a constant W and you make it very negative, then your expansion history goes completely crazy.
No, I don't think so, because also as you go to higher redshift, for a very very negative W, it becomes less and less important as you go to higher redshift. Below -2, there's basically no constraint on W at all, right?
You just get a bigger jerk the more negative W is. Yeah.
But all you're doing is explaining the shape of the light. We want to understand the prior that we should put on top.
There's no idea what's going on. Not yet. No. I'll come back to this in the end, in my positive final remarks. So this W business is, of course, motivating a lot of people, and so with kids we'll be able to get 3 independent handles on this, and we'll have to see how it plays out in terms of accuracy. But both following the growth of structure and the galaxy-galaxy lensing as a function of redshift, and also the non-lensing result on baryon oscillations in the angular correlation function, are independent ways of checking W. And so all of these, in fact, need very good photometric redshifts to work. And so I'll come back to this in a little bit. This is how the wiggles would work. If you have good photometric redshifts, you can bin up the galaxies in redshift slices of about 0.2 in redshift. And that's actually enough to give you to not completely wash out the baryon wiggles in the angular power spectrum. You can then trace what those scales are as a function of redshift, and that gives you your angular diameter distance resolution.
Have you done tests to determine how going to need photosensitivity?
Well, no, we've done tests on how good we think we can do photozines.
Okay.
And that seems to be good enough.
Okay, and good enough, you're saying, is 0.03?
Yes. 0.03 in 1 plus 0. Okay. But I'll come back to that.
That's just in the breakdown?
No, that's pretty much all kinds. It's having these 9 bands really helps.
Did Combo 17 do that well on photometry?
They did about this well. They did, no, there's 0.02, I think. 0.023, I think, was the number.
So how do you train your PhotoZ algorithm? I mean, like, did you also have Inspector for...
Yes, we'll plan to apply. You can use the foreground, you can use the SDSS and the 2DF spectra, but it's probably a different kind of galaxy from what you find in Redshift 1, so I wouldn't want to rely only on that. Okay, so this is how well we think we can do PhotoZs for galaxies below 23.5, 24, and 25. This is the photometric versus input. This is from simulations, so of course this is only as good as the simulations are. But you see that apart from a few outliers, which are specific kind of galaxies that you can just throw out of the catalog based on their colors, you get a very, very small scatter of about 0.03 that only really breaks down once you get to the fainter magnitude. So, again, this is one of those things that you can simulate to death, but in the end you have to see how it pans out in real life. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about the methods we're developing, and then I will stop. These are both related to the shapelets, which is a way of parameterizing shapes of images on the sky. And we're using them both for weak lensing measurements and for the photometry. Right? Or at least we're developing techniques to do that. So shapelets are quite old. Réfléchir introduced them in the lensing game in 2003. And it's basically the idea that you take an image of a source and you expand it as a series around a Gaussian of an appropriately chosen scale, beta that you choose. And then you multiply it by a polynomial up to as high a degree as you dare. And so typically we use terms which go up to combined XY order of 8. So it gives you 45 coefficients to describe a source in grade general. Right, so these are the first few coefficients. The basis one is a Gaussian, and then the various terms give you higher and higher oscillations in this term. It's a complete basis, so you can go as far as you like as long as you have information, enough pixels to try to fit. And the fun thing is that this is actually the eigenfunctions of the quantum harmonic oscillator in 2D. So there's a whole formalism that I used to know and that I went back to my notes and found again, and that Alexandre Réfléchir nicely put in his paper for us. So it means you have these ladder operators which allow you to jump left and right, up and down in this diagram. You can build all the other things in terms of these ladder operations. So you can translate something, you can make a rotation operator, magnification, shear operators, just by combination of these ladder operators, which basically just move sources from one to the other and multiply them by a coefficient. So it's quite fun mathematically, but it's also quite useful. And it means it's once you have an object described as a series of, as a combination of terms like this, it's very easy to compute the effect of all these operations, like magnification and shear, on the coefficients. You can also convolve things. Basically, there are closed form coefficients, or closed form expressions for what happens when you convolve one basis function at a particular scale with another one at a different scale, and you can write the result as a series of coefficients at yet another scale. So you can convolve two of these things and get a good model for the convolution. And that means you can model PSF smearing. By once you know what the PSF is, you can write the PSF as a bunch of shapelets, and that tells you all you need to construct this linear convolution operator. Okay. And that means it's actually quite useful. So for instance, you can make a description of the PSF in an image by looking at all the stars, modeling these, each of them as a PSF, as a shapelet series, and interpolating all the coefficients of the image. And so for example, once you find the stars in an image, then you can go and you can model each of them as a bunch of these coefficients, and you see they give you nice regular models. You can subtract them off from the pixels, and you see there's nothing left, which is good. Sometimes you get a little bit of a residual or some ringing because you're in the wings of a neighbor, and then your interpolation tells you that that's a source that you don't want to deal with. And so once you interpolate that across the image, then you can find a model for the PSF everywhere, not only where you have stars, but also in between.
And that's
what this picture was. It's the classic way of looking at the magnitude size diagram. So that's one thing. It's a great way to define the image quality and characterize it with a set of numbers. Once you have that, once you know how your image is being smeared, then you can try to find the intrinsic ellipticities of the sources in your image. So for example, so basically what you do is you model every source you observe as a smeared piece by the PSF that you've measured, source which is elliptical, i.e. sheared circular. So you have your PSF linear operator, you have your shear linear operator, and you have then a bunch of coefficients which describe a general round source in shapelet terms. And basically, we don't want any of this. We're not interested in the radial profile of the source. We just want these ellipticities. We want to know how elliptical the source is. So you marginalize over all the other parameters and find the best fit ellipticity of the source. And this is, again, very simple. It's nearly linear. So you can do this these fits very quickly, very efficiently on large numbers of sources. And you end up with ellipticities for everything pre-PSF smearing. So this is as good as your PSF model would be. And then once you have these ellipticities, then you can ask how isotropic are they? Because if you have a set of elliptical sources with random orientations and you shear them by a certain amount, it's easy to work out how they respond under shear. So you measure the mean ellipticity of the sources, you measure their dispersion, and you can divide them. That gives you the shear that you need to make that average ellipticity. And so the nice thing about this is that you do all the modeling of the PSF in one go. You start from the very beginning by modeling your sources as something which is smeared by the PSF that you know. And this is different from other things which try to take various bites of this problem step by step. So there's a large program called the STEP program that I think Richard Ellis mentioned in his talk at the conference, where a whole bunch of people that have different algorithms are doing blind simulations to try to see how well, in an honest way, they really are doing in recovering shears. And it's quite a fun experiment to be involved in. The first round of simulations, we all agreed, with a few exceptions where there were bugs that had to be cleared, at the 5 to 10% level in terms of calibration of the shear results, and that was for fairly idealized galaxies. The second round was actually more difficult. The galaxies got more realistic, more nasty, more structure, but everybody improved. So now we're at the few percent accuracy with basically all the methods. And there's still a way to go, so there's now a simulation going on with space-like PSFs and space-like images to try to see how well something like SNAP would work with these methods. So it's clear that we are all improving as a result of this experiment, and it's going to carry on. It's also clear that we've done the easy bits, and so it's getting harder and harder to keep on getting the kind of improvement factors that we're after. But so all the systematics in measuring ellipticity is being tackled through this community effort to try to keep each other honest, and it's working very well so far. So here's an example of the step one results. Here's a whole bunch of, this is basically the calibration error, and you see everybody falls in this band of plus or minus 7%, with a few exceptions. But even so, there are still issues. For example, if you look at the residual as a function of magnitude of the sources, you find some funny effects that are much more significant than the statistics would suggest. So there's plenty of stuff to learn about all these methods, and that's what we're doing. There's also a new kid on the block, which is called flexion, a higher order term in lensing, which is Goldberg and Bacon have been pushing lately, which is the gradient of the shear, so it's the next order thing. So rather than taking a circle and making it into an ellipse, you then shear different bits of it by different amounts, and that makes you different food groups. So you get bananas and eggs, m equals 1 and n equals 3 terms. You don't want to do those together, I think. And the effect is even weaker because it's the next order tide, but it decays faster with radius than shear, and so when you get close to the sources, to the galaxies, you actually can use the signal. So even though it's weaker, it's actually useful because galaxies intrinsically have much less flexion. Galaxies don't look like bananas and eggs. Galaxies look like ellipses. And so that means the intrinsic shape noise is actually lower. Right? So that means even this weaker signal, you're trying to measure it against the lower background of intrinsic shape noise. And so there is a radius at an arc minute or below where the effects actually roughly balance out, which means it's independent information on the dark matter profile. That's right. So for the inner parts near galaxies, it's very useful. And also probably it'll be very useful for the shape measurements, for the ellipticity measurements of the shear profile. And again, you can go back and you can write all this as third powers of these ladder operators. So it all fits perfectly in this shapeless formula at the end. Okay, and then the last thing is a paper I submitted this morning. I just missed the deadline. I've forgotten that I was in the wrong time zone, so I missed the AstroPH deadline. It'll be on there on Monday. But it's a way of measuring accurate colors using these same shaper techniques for extended sources. And this will be the last thing I discuss. If you have point sources, then measuring colors is a solved problem because you know the PSF, so you know how to fit them. But if you have extended sources, then it's actually not a solved problem because it's difficult to define the proper flux for a source. The total flux is ill-defined because usually you have a long tail that sits under the noise and that you can't really measure. And so if you plonk down an aperture, then different PSFs will be affected by different ways. And so it's not obvious how you measure accurate colors from different images and different seeing of the same source. You can have radial color gradients and so all sorts of nasty stuff. And so the typical or the usual approach to this is that you have your intrinsic source and you have a good seeing and a bad seeing image and different filters. And if you've made a straight aperture photometry measurement, you would make an error because in the bad seeing image you're losing more out of your aperture than in the good seeing image. So what you do is you take the good seeing image, you convolve it until it's equivalent to the same PSF as your bad seeing image, and then you can make a comparable image. Now that's good if you have only two bands, you have to do this convolution once. But in a 9-band survey, you'll be doing a lot of these convolutions and reconvolutions to try to match all the different seeings. It's very laborious. And so we've developed a different method, which is catalog-based. And the Dutch people in the audience will see how exciting this subject really is. So this is a weighted flux that you would observe with a Gaussian aperture and PSF. You can ask him afterwards. So basically what you do is you take your intrinsic source, intrinsic light distribution, you smear it with a Gaussian PSF, and then you photometer that with a radially Gaussian weight function. Right, so there's your Gaussian PSF, there's your Gaussian weight function, and so it doesn't take much to swap the integrals and to see that that's a simple Gaussian weight function of the intrinsic light distribution. And this is, of course, a theoretical flux. It's simply a function of the light distribution and the aperture radius Q that you've chosen. So that's a theoretical quantity, but the point is you can measure this from images in the presence of a PSF. Again, and the algorithm we've developed is again based on this shapeless thing. So this is the demonstration of how it works. Basically what you do is you take you measure the point spread function, you describe it as shapelets. You can use that, you can construct this linear PSF convolution operator, invert the matrix, and then reconvolve with a Gaussian PSF. So that's how you do this step of trying to work out what the source would look like if it were convolved with a Gaussian PSF as opposed to the nasty PSF that you have on your image. And it turns out to be quite a stable procedure with shapelets. So here's a whole bunch of simulations with different PSFs, clearly things which don't look like shapelets in detail, and a whole bunch of different galaxies with various Sausage profiles and some spiral structure. And you see that if you simply implement this recipe in terms of shapelets, you find you get the correct flux, this Gaussian weighted, Gaussian convolved flux, to the few percent level as a function of aperture radius. If you then have one iteration where you go back and clean up all the pixel residuals that your shapelet function didn't quite fit properly, then you can get down to this. And now you're talking sub-percent level accuracy systematics. So this completely corrects for point spread function differences, completely corrects for aperture differences, and gives you a real color of exactly the same part of the galaxy, even though different colors will have been measured with very different point spread functions. And so the systematic error is essentially negligible, and this is what you need to be able to get reliable photometric redshifts. Sorry, this is the scale, this is the size of the best fit Gaussian to your image, which is what you use to as your zeroth order shapelet coefficient. That's what you expand everything about. Absolute flux calibration you still have to do, just like, and you, this doesn't get around that problem. So you do it, what we've done is we've observed a number of standard star fields, and we will just regularly go back to there and measure the zero points. With these photometric redshift codes, what people also do is they have one loop where they tweak the zero point for the whole field to see if that makes the whole fit to the library, to the whole global fit better, and then that's, those few hundreds can make a big difference in the quality of the photometric redshifts and reduce the scatter quite a bit. So, but photometric calibration we still have to do like everybody else.
Can you go back once?
Yeah.
So Gaussian radius? Is that Gaussian radius?
No, of the smeared source on the sky.
Okay.
And so this is simulations where the source can be six times the size of the PSF or can be totally unresolved. They're all sitting in here. They all fall on the same. You're able to correct all of them.
So you can play with your aperture relatively reliable to factor the factors.
You can go up and down by a factor of two. And so if you have a 0.6 arc second seeing image and a 1.1 arc second seeing image, you can certainly compensate for that. Yeah. And that's what we need in this practical case. So it's a way of getting a PSF-independent photometric quantity just from a single image, which means you can make a catalog, and then you can take the colors out of the catalogs and just divide them and get real colors, which normally you don't get. Normally you have to go back to the pixels and do this matching before you can compare the colors. So that's a great practical advantage when you have lots of data and lots of different images at different places scattered around Europe, basically. We can exchange catalogs rather than images, at least in the first instance.
It must depend also on your signal-to-noise. You can probably play this game safely here.
If you go to a much smaller PSF, you're increasing your noise. Yeah. Sure.
So this works at your typical detection.
But if you want to measure a color, it's not actually optimal to take the best seeing image and smear it to the worst seeing. There's a good medium. You don't want to deconvolve the worst seeing all the way to the best seeing either. That doesn't work. But there's a quite a flat range in between where you can get reliable results.
And biased colors down to your detection limit?
No, of course not. No.
So what is the practical limit for biased colors? Is it all of the survey 10%?
So
are we a pattern of that?
I'm not sure. It depends on the detection limit that we implement. So for different applications you will use different detection limits. I can't give you a real number. Okay, I think I should wind up. So this is the survey that I told you about. This is the observatory where it's all going to happen. This is the teams that are involved. So there's a group in Leiden, that's me, in Groningen is the data center in the Netherlands, Edwin Valentijn is leading that, Ralph Bender's group at MPE in Munich, Yannick Mellier in Paris, Mario Radovic in Naples, Peter Schneider in Bonn, Andy Taylor in Edinburgh, Will Sutherland in Cambridge, and Steve Warren in Imperial are all involved in this. The UK groups are mainly involved through the VISTA angle, and all of us together are going to try to make this happen. And then after kids, or in the future, and more taking a slightly broader view in terms of dark matter, of course, what we really have to do is find the dark matter particle to make this a satisfying scientific endeavor, right? And eventually it'll happen, I guess, or we will decide that we're barking up the wrong tree. Technically, to be able to model these things, we actually need better models of the predicted growth of structure in the nonlinear regime than we have at the moment. The n-body simulations are not accurate enough to distinguish between the various expansion scenarios in different lambda CDM with W models. So this is something that can be solved, but it has to be done. It will take work. terms of studying the dark energy, it would be nice to have some real theories to test rather than this one number, which nobody really believes has any real physics in it. On the observational side, there's lots of work being started. LSST and SNAP, or whatever the space satellite will be able to improve accuracies dramatically when they eventually happen. And then you could imagine that you first of all try to see whether you really have something which does not look like a cosmological constant, and then you can try to map its variation with expansion history. And there are claims at the moment that weak lensing combined with photometric redshifts is a very, and perhaps even the most promising technique to make a real impact on this. And this is very sensitive to getting all the systematic effects that I discussed under incredibly tight control, and it's certainly fair to say we're not there yet. As far as kids is concerned, we got an interesting letter from ESO that asks why stop at 1,500 square degrees? Wouldn't we like to do more, 3,000 or more? So I wrote a nice letter in response to that. Very enthusiastic, of course. And the other thing is it'll be a fantastic mine, a fantastic database to do a next generation very deep spectroscopic survey, which we're trying to do with the AAT, for instance. It would be a great place to do a Spitzer post-cryo map to have several thousand square degrees of infrared galaxies, et cetera, et cetera. So I'll stop there, and if you don't see me for the next 5 years, then you know what I'm doing. Thank you.
Can you comment on how the various parameters of the survey decide size compare to PanSTARRS and DES?
So DES will cover 5,000 square degrees, yeah. So three times the size. It won't have infrared, unless they talk to the VISTA people also. And won't do U-band, as far as I know. I'm not sure.
I think it's U-band.
There will be U-band? Okay.
You're right. It's currently VR, I think.
So I worry about how well you can do photo-Zs with that. So my guess is eventually they will need to find a way to get infrared at least.
Right.
Incorporate. PanSTARRS, I'm not really sure what the plan is. Except I think that they have this very different survey strategy where they have to go over the sky many, many times, so it'll take a long time before they get the useful depths to be able to play this game. I don't know how, in what order they're going to do their filters, their colors, so it'll depend a lot on how they build up to the weak lensing depth to see what they can
do. I don't think they're planning to do it in the first round, right? PanSTARRS 1 is not
going to
be...
PanSTARRS 4, which presumably will happen then. In principle, it could blow us out of the water if they decide that this is what they want to do. But of course, it's the other hemisphere.
It's the other hemisphere. What's the time scale, Professor?
2010.
Okay.
Plus.
Plus.
But they're now really actively getting partners to...
They actually
had
it on top.
They already have
partners.
Yeah, so. Which means that they're certainly moving beyond PanSTARRS 1. Yeah.
So I have two questions. One thing is that with this, how many bands you have? 9? Or yeah. So you said you can determine the photo Z quite accurately. I just wonder whether with that kind of photo Z, you in fact can already estimate the luminosity to some, 20% or 30%. You already can use that to use as foreground lenses, for example.
Yes. No, that's plenty good enough because the lensing efficiency is such a broad function that this is... The crucial thing is not so much for the lensing part, is not really the 3% scatter. Uh-huh. It's being able to know exactly where you're sitting. If you move all the galaxies by 0.5%, that'll do something horrible to your W measurement. So it's the mean that's important, and you have to know how many galaxies you're scattering into completely different photo Z bins. So you have to understand this transfer matrix very well. And that, of course, helps if your distribution is narrower.
So remind me, if I convert this ancillary into distance, what kind of percentage is I think it's 20%.
I mean, distance goes like redshift, right?
Mm-hmm.
Distance is proportional to redshift.
Distance, you have a 3%, or 0.03
it's three,
times 1 plus Z, right?
Oh, times 1 plus Z, yeah.
So
redshift 1, it's a 6%.
6%, right. Yeah, then luminosity is the square of that, 12% or something, or LLM.
But that that's what we will do, so we will...
Yeah.
So I started off by saying that we can use the 2DF and the SCSS spectroscopic galaxies as our foreground lenses, but of course we can use...
Yeah, so you have many, many more lens galaxies, as well as, you know, they are maybe at a better ratio for this kind of thing.
Yeah. But second and for those, it doesn't really matter if a few are in the wrong direction.
Right. And the second thing is that you mentioned a little bit, you know, this there are a lot of this, you know, deep surveys going on. And eventually, do you think, just for the last point that you made, eventually, realistically, how many galaxies we can really just have redshift, for example?
Spectroscopic?
Yeah. And this, for example, in this case, eventually, you know, to what kind of magnitude limit you can measure real redshift?
To what magnitude? Well, so you could try to do something like the VMOS deep survey or deep over this whole area, but it's going to take you far too long.
Well, I guess my real question is this, you know, in say 10 or 20 years, do we still need to rely on photo Z to do many, many things, or in fact, if we wait for 10
will
years...
Will it be possible to keep up spectroscopically with this survey? 10 years from now, I don't think so.
But even 10 years from now, you cannot have a redshift for all the galaxies, right? You only have a redshift
sure.
for part of it, and the brighter part of it.
Mm-hmm. So, for example, we consider trying to do a survey on the AAT using the big new spectrograph on 2DF. And there we thought of something like 150 square degrees mm-hmm. down several magnitudes beyond the depth of Sloan and the 2DF. And that already is hundreds of nights.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody has to do it. We're going to be busy.
So it looks like you've done quite a bit of work on the distortions introduced by the telescope, the effect on the beta. We looked at the spectra of Shapley coefficients that get induced by the distortions. Is there some way you can improve the PSF correction by using
the ray tracing information?
And the Shapley expansions of your PSF.
So you do incorporate all that information in the...
Are they a good beta set for describing the telescope distortions? Or?
Oh, I see what you mean. I haven't looked at that. I don't see why they should be particularly. But you know, it's a nice orthogonal basis set, so in principle they can describe everything. We don't expect any fine structure in the PSF once you... So the PSFs are very small. All the light falls within... Well, 80% of the light falls within 0.4 arc second. All over the field, even in the corners. So by the time you smear that with the seeing, that should... dominate largely. But the best thing is you don't really want to predict the PSF, you want to measure it from the stars in the same image as your gamma.
Right, but the Jarvis and Jane stacking of stars in many different fields seems to work quite nicely. And maybe you could extend
to find these principal components in the...
Right, and if you extend it further into more orders of shapes rather than just the first two, maybe you could help yourself out.
I haven't looked into that.
All right. Thanks.